Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. To ensure that all Americans who want to vote can vote in November, state and federal elections officers will have to make critical decisions right now. To hold a national election during a pandemic will require creative thinking and money and communication to protect the public's health when they vote and the security of the voting system itself. So this hour on Point, we'll think through how to guarantee the safety and security of the November elections. And we'll start today with Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 correspondent and WBUR senior political reporter. He joins us from Dublin, New Hampshire. Hi there, Anthony.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so let's start off with, just broadly speaking, what are the main concerns about November 2020?
Yeah, big concerns, and they sort of fall into three categories. First, you know, the result of the pandemic and issues around voter safety at the polls this coming November. We saw what happened in March during the Wisconsin primary. After Republicans insisted that primary go forward, you know, it was a mess. It was a disaster. Lines of voters wrapped around city blocks in the midst of a pandemic. In Milwaukee, something like five out of one. So Milwaukee, the size of Boston, five out of 180 precincts were open. And lots of people got infected. They got sick with COVID-19 because of that. So that's a big concern. The second concern is one that's been here for a while, and that's outside interference in the election. We've known for some time that Russia is still interfering with our elections, planting misinformation on social media and so on and so forth. The pandemic only creates a more fertile soil, if you will, for that kind of disruption. And finally, the third concern is efforts within the U.S. to undermine confidence in the electoral system. I mean, we've seen efforts of like this, of that coming, for example, from President Trump. Going back to 2016, he talked about busloads of voters from Massachusetts voting in New Hampshire. There was no evidence of that. He talked about the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote was a result of widespread voter fraud. He set up a commission to look into it. There was no evidence of that. But all of that sows a lack of confidence in the electoral system, and all those issues are very much with us today.
Mm-hmm. Indeed they are. And as you just laid out, Anthony, they range from interference and misinformation down to the mechanics of voting itself. So these different problems have different solutions. I mean, what are some of the solutions, say, starting with the safety of citizens as they go to the polls?
Right. Well, one of the things that's being talked about a lot is gearing up vote by mail. And there's a lot of focus on this, and it is part of the solution. But here's the problem. It costs a lot of money, postage, printing ballots, training election workers, educating the public. And Republicans don't want to fund that effort right now. In the last $2 trillion stimulus package, Democrats wanted to include $2 billion for sort of election preparedness that would have included gearing up voting by mail. But they only got a fraction of that. And President Trump views voting by mail as an invitation to voter fraud, even though there's scant evidence of that. Finally, if there is to be widespread voter by mail, the effort to organize has to start now because it takes a while to set it up.
It does indeed take a while to set it up. Anthony, you still with us? Okay, well, we're going to have to get Anthony Brooks back, but actually, let's shift our focus to one of the other issues that Anthony brought up, and that is foreign interference or meddling in the election. And joining us now is Congressman Adam Schiff. He's Democrat representing California's 28th district and, of course, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Representative Schiff, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Frankly speaking, how much confidence can and should voters have in the safety and security of the November 2020 elections?
Well, I would agree with Anthony. I think the first issue among equals is access to the ballot by Americans in the midst of a pandemic. So concerns over people's health, whether we will make ready access to vote by mail. We're putting a significant amount of new funding in the new HEROES Act for that kind of vote by mail, vote at home effectively while you're sheltering in place. But second to that, I would say the Russians are not only likely to be back. Indeed, they've never left. They've continued interfering with us. And I think that if you look back at 2016, one of the things that they did quite successfully was seek to manipulate these great divides in American society, divides over ethnicity, over immigration status, over abortion, any number of really hot button issues. Well, the great divide in the fall is going to be over the pandemic. That will be the number one, two, and three issues in the election campaign. So we can fully anticipate that the Russians are going to seek to exploit those divisions, egg on protests like we see already. And that's my primary concern in terms of foreign intervention.
Congressman, so just specifically right now, you said we can anticipate that. Is there evidence that is going on right now? And if so, specifically, what evidence is that?
There's certainly evidence that the Russians are continuing to interfere on social media. And I'm obviously cabined in what I can tell you in terms of intelligence sources, but I can, you know, certainly share that the private companies that watch their platforms have already identified and taken down inauthentic accounts. They've seen, I think, the Russians are trying perhaps more successfully to hide their hand and not be quite so obvious in terms of having a troll farm operating from St. Petersburg, but try to outsource some of their social media interference in our election. So they've never stopped. What we've seen is an intensification around elections of these activities. In the midterm elections, for example, the Russians engaged in spear phishing attacks like they had 2 years earlier. We didn't see the broad hacking and dumping operations. So, that's one question we have going into the fall is, will they be as brazen as they were in 2016? Or do they feel now that the repercussions are too great if they show their hand too visibly? But I am deeply concerned that the president's actions have only encouraged further Russian interference, not discouraged it.
Let me just double check if we've got Anthony Brooks back with us. You with us, Anthony?
I think I am.
Yeah. Did you have a question? I've got several more questions for the congressman, but Anthony, did you have one?
Yeah, I have a question. Congressman, good to talk to you. I'm just curious what you think, how the pandemic sort of itself makes the ground more fertile for Russian intervention in 2020. Does it make things worse, more tentative in a sense?
It does, I think, make things worse because there is this great new divide for the Russians to stoke American divisions and animosities. The Russians right now are watching these protests going on in state capitals where you have heavily armed people going to call for the reopening of government before health experts are saying it's safe to reopen the government. This gives the Russians, great opportunity to do the same kind of false flag operations where they were actually able to stimulate and spark protests in the United States from their cubicles in St. Petersburg. But it also, I think, helps to undermine American confidence in our own democratic form of governance to exacerbate these divisions, these protests, these angers that Americans have towards their own government or towards each other. The goal in 2016 for the Russians was, yes, to help the preferred candidate, Donald Trump, and to hurt Hillary Clinton. But their goal also was to weaken American society, cause Americans to question their own society. This allows Putin to trumpet the advantages of his autocratic model. China right now is much the same, making use of this, response, this, I think very unsuccessful, indeed incompetent response by the administration to the pandemic, the level of infection in the United States, the level of death in the United States. China is using it to propagandize and say, look, our autocratic model is superior. We're sending protective gear to the United States, not the other way around. So, we can expect, I think, any adversary or competitor to use this issue to their advantage, and they already are.
Well, Congressman, let me ask you. So this has always, the umbrella term interference contains within it a lot of different and complex aspects to it. I mean, you have heard the criticism for several years now, and I think it also applies in 2020, that as much discontent as Russian troll farms may want to foment in the United States, that there has yet been any evidence that actually led to the change in how voters behaved, right? Like amplifying their ill will against each other is different than changing ballots at the ballot box. So do you think that why would that be any different in November 2020? That we can all snipe at each other, but there's no evidence that people changed their vote or votes were changed because of Russian interference.
Well, those are two very different things, whether people changed their votes and whether they actually manipulated the vote count. In terms of whether people changed their votes, whether the significant Russian campaign in 2016, for example, affected the outcome because people saw this Russian content on social media and were moved to vote a certain way, or because of the hacking and dumping operation and the documents forced the Clinton campaign constantly to be on the defense. I can tell you one person who felt that it was very consequential, and that was Donald Trump, who cited these Russian hacked documents and their daily release over 100 times on the campaign trail. So certainly that campaign, really both campaigns, thought it was deeply influential in terms of American minds. And now, you're right, we didn't see the Russians hack and change the vote counts. We saw them infiltrate voter registration databases and do other attacks on the technology to probe the technology. But we didn't see them manipulate the vote. So how can we be certain that they will or they won't in 2020? And the short answer is we can't be certain, but we can be prepared. And we don't know, are the Russians going to be more risk averse or less this fall?
Congressman, will you hang on for just a second? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we do have to take a quick break. And you're absolutely right about those Russian probes into voting rolls in various states. So Congressman Schiff and Anthony Brooks, hang on for just a moment. We're talking about what it will take to guarantee the safety and security of the November 2020 elections. There's a lot more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about what it's going to take to guarantee the safety and security of the 2020 elections. And I'm joined today by Representative Adam Schiff. He's chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He joins us from Washington. And Anthony Brooks is also with us from Dublin, New Hampshire. He's On Point's 2020 correspondent.
Congressman Schiff, I have a question about we've been talking about Russian interference, but this is sort of a broader question about ensuring the right to vote for everyone. And it involves your state, California, which became the first state in the nation to shift to all mail voting because of the pandemic. If I have that correct, your governor, Governor Newsom, ordered ballots to be mailed to all 20 million voters for the November elections. Is that a good sort of route for the rest of the country to go. How do you feel about that?
I think it really is for several reasons, the most important being that it will avoid the conflict that we saw in Wisconsin, where people had to choose their health or their vote. You know, the fact that people were lined up in long lines, that poll workers were exposed to getting sick, that many people did get sick as a result of exercising their franchise is just an abomination, that we can't allow, you know, that kind of, you know, draconian choice to confront voters in the fall. So the safest way when you're sheltering in place, and many states may still have some form of that in the fall when the virus comes back or if it resurges, the safest way to shelter in place and vote is to vote in place, vote in your home through a vote by mail. We put $3.6 billion in this latest legislation unveiled yesterday to help the states afford to set up vote by mail. And it can be done safely. It can be done securely. You know, in a great illustration of the president saying the secret thing out loud, he recently said that if more Americans, effectively, if more Americans are able to vote, if we make it easier to vote in these ways, no Republican will ever get elected. Now, I don't think that's true, but if it is, it's a good reason for them to change their candidates and their platform, not to disenfranchise people or force them to make this choice between health or vote. Mm.
Well, Congressman Anthony was telling us earlier that the efforts in Washington to encourage vote by mail across the country do not have any Republican support. So even if the Democrats introduce legislation, I mean, realistically speaking, does it have any hope in clearing both houses of Congress?
Well, I would hope that, you know, as a part of this package, we would not only be protecting the health of our people and the health of our economy, but also helping the health of our democracy and supporting the health of our democracy. You're right. There is Republican opposition for the reason that Donald Trump expressed. They think that more people voting is bad for the GOP. And indeed, it's consistent with a strategy that Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy have been using for years, which is to disenfranchisement, particularly minority voters, but disenfranchisement. The GOP political model is based on the idea of fewer people voting every year. That's the only way they can continue to hold power. And, you know, that I think is rejected around the country. Many Republican governors reject that idea as well. But we're going to have to, I think, make an issue of the fact that the GOP, among other things, among their otherwise abysmal handling of this crisis, they're also trying to prevent people from voting. It didn't succeed in Wisconsin. It was done there to elect a very conservative Supreme Court justice. That failed. I think it will be a failure in November, but we've got to work hard to make sure that people don't have to risk their lives to support their democracy.
I do wonder, Congressman, if this is a place in which the issues of potential Russian interference and the pandemic do strongly overlap, because one thing that foreign actors didn't have in the run-up to the 2016 election was a credible health threat, which we all are facing right now. I mean, can we imagine a situation in which troll farms, you know, regardless of what country they come from, put out misinformation about the safety of going to the polls in November, and that in effect produces a voter suppression outcome?
Oh, without a doubt. If the Russians think it's to their advantage or to help their preferred candidate, you can absolutely be assured that they will push out content along those lines. I think we can also anticipate the Russians pushing out content along the president's line, which is that voting by mail is somehow subject to fraud in a way that voting in person is not, when there's no evidence of that. But the Russians will push that out because there will be several other divides within the great pandemic divide, and one of them will be about voting by mail. So, yes, we can expect whatever really sensitive issues there are, the Russians to exploit them. And in particular, you know, if they once again strongly favor one presidential candidate over the other, and I have to think that they will, in Donald Trump, he is a dream candidate and president from the Russian point of view, that they will stoke the issues that they think help his campaign, much the way they stoked the immigration issue because they thought it helped his campaign, or they stoked Black Lives Matter because they felt that, you know, perversely helped his campaign.
Congressman, I have one more question about the effort to expand vote by mail across the country. And I know Democrats would like to get a lot more funding to do that. Do you think there's time? Because that's the big issue. The clock is sort of running down on November 2020. And everything that has to be done in order to prepare counties all across the country to process, you know, tens of millions of vote by mail ballots, it's a huge undertaking and time is running out.
It is a big undertaking. States should embark on that now, just as the California governor has announced. They need to be looking ahead. The health experts are telling us what we can expect, and that is it will very likely be the case that the virus will resurge in the fall, which means that we need to be ready. We need to be ready in terms of preparing our hospitals. We need to be ready in terms of preparing our vote. I think it's malpractice to do anything else. So, yes, it's going to take time. We rolled out a new technology in LA in the primary, electronic technology, that had very serious flaws. It wasn't ready for prime time. I think it's part of the reason why LA County moved to an all-mail mail-in election in addition to the pandemic considerations. So any new system, whether it's electronic or it's the old-fashioned one, can be a challenge. But the good news in terms of vote by mail is every state has experience with vote by mail. Every county does. It's been in existence for quite some time. Not on the scale and scope that we're talking about, but it's really an old technology rather than a new one.
Well, Congressman Schiff, I have one last question for you. The Wall Street Journal today, in an editorial, really came out swinging against you, basically saying that the American people should not trust a word you say. The editorial said, quote, "Interviews with the Trump campaign or administration officials yielded no conclusion, no collusion evidence. Mr. Schiff had access to these transcripts, even as he claimed he had ample proof of collusion and wrote his false report." Again, this is the words from the Wall Street Journal's editorial. And they claim that you are still making things up, that you're a powerful figure with access to secrets that the rest of us don't have and can't check. And then it concludes, the editorial concludes by saying, "As for Mr. Schiff, no one should ever believe another word he says." What's your response to that?
Well, the Wall Street Journal has some great reporters. They really do fabulous journalism, but they have a terrible editorial page which mimics Fox News primetime. So this is the Fox Trump line, which they're happy to echo for their own reasons. But their problem is it's at odds with the facts. The report, you know, our transcripts as well as the Mueller report show that the Russians offered dirt to the Trump campaign. They put it in writing. They said it was part of the Russian government's own effort to help the Trump campaign. And Don Jr. accepted and said he would love that help. And they set up a secret meeting in Trump Tower that the president's son and son-in-law and campaign chairman attended. And then they lied about the meeting. That's very direct evidence of collusion. You had the campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, released from prison today, interestingly. Paul Manafort providing internal campaign polling data to someone linked to Russian intelligence. You had the Russians telling the foreign policy advisor, George Papadopoulos, that they had hacked Hillary Clinton emails that they could publish through cutouts. And then you had the Russians publish those emails through cutouts. You had Roger Stone, the president's advisor, in touch with cutouts, in contact with Julian Assange about information prior to releases of those emails. All of that is abundant evidence of collusion, which the vast majority of the American people recognize. But apparently the Wall Street Journal editorial page doesn't, because, you know, essentially they have a business interest in mouthing the same stuff you hear from Fox primetime.
Well, Representative Adam Schiff is a Democrat for California's 28th district and, of course, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman Schiff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Anthony, let me swing back to you here a little bit and just get sort of some of your thoughts on what Congressman Schiff was saying about the prospect of vote by mail or what it's going to take to help states really secure their voting systems come November.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I know we're going to get into this as this hour goes forward, but I mean, I think vote by mail, I mean, we talked about some of the challenges, just the huge cost and the time and the logistical challenge it will take to set it up. But even voting advocates don't talk about it as sort of the panacea, because at the same time, if we put resources and effort and money into setting up vote by mail, we don't necessarily want it to diminish in-person voting, because not everybody finds it easy to vote by mail. And there have been studies that have shown that, for example, lots of African-American communities, low-income communities, depend more on in-person voting. So as we make an effort to expand vote by mail, I think we want to be careful that that doesn't mean we take away making in-person voting as safe as it can be as well.
Right.
So and that's one of the big concerns.
And I was also going to say that I think you made an excellent point earlier about the time that it takes to set up a safe and secure vote by mail system. I mean, having grown up in Oregon, they've been doing it for a couple of decades now, but it took them years to get it to really prepare to have universal vote by mail there. And the thought that we might have it within a couple of months in the middle of a pandemic is it's quite a thought. It's quite an ambitious one. So, Anthony,
it's true.
Yeah, go ahead. No, yeah, go ahead.
No, one quick thing. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned universal vote by mail in Oregon, because another state that's been doing that is Utah, a very Republican state. And it's just interesting how vote by mail has become such a partisan issue. It wasn't always that way. And it was very popular in the West among Republican governors, at least one or two Republican governors. Utah is a pretty good example of that. So it is interesting how it has become such a partisan issue when once upon a time it wasn't.
Hmm. Well, Anthony, hang on here for just a second, because I want to turn now to Bertrell Ross. Bertrell is joining us from Oakland, California. He's the Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and member of the Ad Hoc Committee for 2020 Election Fairness and Legitimacy. And they recently released a report including recommendations to advance the legitimacy and the public's confidence in the 2020 election. So, Professor Ross, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be on.
So let me ask you, I really appreciated how Anthony pointed out that essentially what's at the foundation of this is that elections are run by states. And Washington can do whatever it wants to do to try and fund new election technology or vote by mail, et cetera. But we still have a patchwork of 50 different states here. Is that one of the main concerns in terms of being sure that the November 2020 election is guaranteed to be safe and trustworthy?
Yes, it certainly is an impediment. You have 50 different election systems in place, and that doesn't even account for the many different political subdivisions and localities that have their own election processes as well. And so it raises challenges with respect to creating a system in which Americans understand how it works in every place that they live, and ensuring that a vote is safe in all the places in which people live. So that's something that's going to have to be overcome in education campaigns and in the processes and means of voting that are set up.
Well, so let's sort of peel this layer by layer. First of all, I mean, just talking about the confidence, the emotional and intellectual confidence that voters need to have in November 2020. How do we build up that confidence?
Yeah, I think that one key thing is on the front end, making people feel comfortable about the safety of the election. I kind of think about voting in the 2020 election in the way that we're thinking about the pandemic, in the sense that we want to avoid a voting surge. We want to avoid a system of voting that will lead to a heightened curve. We want to spread the voting out as much as possible through as many diverse means of voting. So it's not just the vote by mail solution, which has been advanced in legislation and by many experts. It's going to be very difficult to implement such a program in the time that we have, as you and Anthony have pointed out. And the fact is that many Americans aren't used to voting by mail, and this could have a disparate impact on economically and politically marginalized communities. So we need to kind of think beyond sort of vote by mail, although that's a good part of the solution, to other means in which we can make voting and avoid easier or make voting safe and avoid the surge. One thing is early voting and advertising and educating people on the opportunities for early voting so that we have in-person voting places that are not crowded and that do not create health risk or limit the health risk that individuals might face in voting. You might set up systems in which you provide for curbside voting. Mm. You might try to imagine an appointment system for voting, just different sort of innovative tools that could potentially be put in place right. to avoid a voting surge on election day.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Anthony, did you have a comment or a question for Professor Ross?
Yeah, I'm intrigued, Professor Ross, by those that last point you made in terms of early voting, drive-up voting, curbside voting. What do we know about the number of states that have? I vote in Massachusetts, for example. I know they have early voting there. How widespread is that?
It's not as it's more widespread than it has been in the past. Majority of states do provide for early voting in one form or the other. And I think that with states like California, which has now a vote center model in place in some places and early voting throughout the state, the key challenge has been to get people to vote early. Even though voting early is accessible in a majority of states, not as many Americans do vote early as would be necessary to avoid the health consequences from this election. So it's available. It has to be made available by legislation. So I don't have the confidence that states that do not have early voting will implement it by the time of election day. But those that have it can improve upon it by educating Americans about the availability of it.
I'm curious, Professor Ross, I used the word sort of confidence earlier, but what about legitimacy? Is that sort of a separate channel of education that needs to go on in order for people to believe in the legitimacy of the outcome in November?
Absolutely. I think that that's key. And I think that there are kind of two points at which legitimacy can be advanced. If we think back to past elections, past presidential elections, and I know you have a break coming up. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So I'm going to I'll let you get to those two points on the other side of the break.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you for being a keen listener there. So Bertrand Ross and Anthony Brooks, stand by for a moment. We are talking about what it will take to guarantee the safety and legitimacy of November 2020. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we are going to be talking about quarantine fatigue and quarantine anxiety. Be honest, we're a couple of months in. Are you bending the rules right now? Is your behavior changing? Or do you feel really judgmental, really judgy of others if they're not wearing their masks or keeping appropriate social distancing? What are you most overwhelmed by? And what are you really yearning to do again? So we want to hear from you about quarantine fatigue. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today we're talking about how to guarantee the safety and legitimacy of the November 2020 elections. And I'm joined by Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 correspondent with us from Dublin, New Hampshire. And Bertrand Ross is also with us. He's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. And Professor Ross, you were saying before the break that there are two main things that need to happen so that people have faith in the legitimacy of November 2020.
Yes, Meghna. In terms of the legitimacy of our past elections, they've been so dependent on losers conceding closely fought elections and past presidential elections is what I'm speaking of. And this is the story of 2000. It wasn't the Supreme Court that ended the 2000 election crisis. It was Vice President Al Gore's decision to concede the race. And what we had in the last election was candidate Trump challenging the legitimacy of the election prior to the election, describing the process as rigged and warning his followers that the election could be stolen. And we see some of that action and behavior now prior to this next election to come. And so part of the legitimacy crisis that needs to be resolved is how do we sort of ensure on the back end a willingness to concede the election, of the loser to concede the election? Because if the loser does not concede the election, that could raise many complications and challenges in the post-election process. Now, it doesn't have to be merely the candidates that concede the election. It could be a set of political officials and elected officials that come together on a bipartisan basis to acknowledge the victor of that election. And that would ideally mute or limit the effectiveness of the message that the loser might be making that the election was illegitimate. Or it could be a set of election officials that come together. Another part of it is, a second part of it has to do with media. Now, if we move to mail-in elections, and I think that there will be a lot more mail ballots this election, what that does is that it slows down the counting process. And as a result, we may not have results on the night of the election. And the challenge with that is that media has a strong need and desire to announce the winner on the night of the election. There's a lot of frustration that media feels when they're not able to announce the winner on the night of the election. And to the extent that they give in to that emotion and announce a winner in a place that the winner has not, this candidate has not won, that could lead to a problem and legitimacy crisis if it ultimately turns out that after the counting of all the ballots, the election has shifted to the other candidate. And so it's kind of educating the media, creating some patience in the announcement of elections that could sort of improve the sense of legitimacy of the results.
Professor Russ, I'm glad you brought up the 2000 election, because I've been thinking about that a lot and what we might learn from that experience. I covered that election and that was election confusion on a massive scale from just one state. It caused a major electoral crisis. Confusion caused millions of Americans to at least have their faith shaken in the system. So I'm imagining 2020 voting amidst a pandemic and the potential for that kind of confusion across, a dozen states or maybe more. So I guess my question out of that is, did we learn something specifically from 2000, the election of 2000, that we can apply to 2020?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right, Anthony. And thinking about, 2020 could be 2000 on the scale of 10 to 12 times greater in terms of the number of states that could have challenges. Because again, voting is going to be very different than it was in 2000, in the sense that people are going to have to figure out different ways of voting, which means there have to be different means of counting those ballots, which could create different types of challenges associated with that election. So what can we learn from that particular election? Well, we can learn that in 2000 that the courts can be an arbiter of these elections, but there may be, if there are challenges post-election, the courts shouldn't necessarily be relied on as the ultimate arbiter that can decide these particular questions. Now, what the Supreme Court did in that election was decide a question of whether these votes can be recounted on the basis of a constitutional principle. I don't know if that can be sort of the relied on method. What I think that the election suggests is that the political branches of government may have a role to play in deciding this particular election, or at least determining the legitimacy of the election. So that's one part of it. A second part of it is the role of election officials. Catherine Harris, as Secretary of State during that election, there was a host of issues with that management and administration of that particular election. And I think that what election officials have learned from that election is how to go about the post-election process in a way that is educating the public, informing the public of what's going on, how ballots being counted, what the delays are, what the difficulties are, so that the public has trust in how the process is being carried out.
To be frank, I have images of hanging chads flashing through my head and imagining that an order of magnitude larger in November of this year is sending a chill down my spine, to be perfectly honest. But Anthony and Bertrand, hold on for just a second here, because there's been a lot of activity online in response to this hour. And On Point producer Dori Scheimer is here to share some of what On Point listeners are saying.
Yeah, as we talk about the legitimacy of the election, one thing that we have heard from a number of listeners, including Lance Rangel, saying vote by mail is promoting voter fraud. If we can stand in line at Walmart to get food, we can stand in line to vote. It's always Democrats who claim fraud when they lose, but the will of the people when they win. So we're hearing a lot of that sentiment and what Donald Trump has raised, that vote by mail leads to voter fraud.
Yeah, so Anthony mentioned the scant evidence of that before, but Professor Ross, let me turn to you. Is there, just to repeat the question, is there any evidence that there's widespread voter fraud in states that have gone to all vote by mail?
There is no evidence of widespread voter fraud. It's not to say that voter fraud can't happen. Voter fraud is it's a small problem, but it's a problem that has occurred. We saw in the 2018 election, a Republican operative in North Carolina for a congressional candidate was involved in a fraudulent scheme involving absentee ballots. So it is possible, but there I want to sort of tell the listener that there are means by which a system could be put in place to check that fraud or to limit that fraud. So we have a signature verification system in most states in which signatures on the back of a mail-in ballot have to be verified by an election official to make sure that that person who voted is the person that submitted the absentee ballot. Now, these aren't perfect because people's signatures change. And the signature verification match has been shown to have a disproportionate impact on, could have a disproportionate impact on Black and brown communities, for example. There's also a way to track ballots through the mail. If the question is whether the ballot is getting from the home to the polling place in a way that is legitimate and without fraud, then you put a tracking system in place to verify that the transmission of that ballot has occurred in an appropriate way. There's ways in which you can sort of limit fraud. And I think it's important, though, that we maintain the health of individuals in elections. And yes, we stand in line in Walmart to buy our food or at Safeway in my town of Oakland. But the fact is, in voting in person requires that people stand in line for a long period of time. And what we know, at least from health experts in terms of transmission, right, that long period of time together, even if you kind of manage to maintain 6 feet apart most of the time, that long period of time together could raise the health risk of individuals. And we want to limit that as much as possible.
Well, I mean, look, yes, there are long lines, but of course, there's a whole nother set of solutions to that we haven't talked about. More polling places, voting over several days. There are lots of, there's a lot of ways that don't include vote by mail to increase the level of safety by reducing the number of people at the polls at any particular time. But I don't actually hear any of those ideas on the table. But Professor Ross, one thing I wanted to ask you about the technological things we can do to secure a vote by mail system. It all involves machines and systems that need to be in place before November, right? And we have to have laws that have to be passed too. So I'm wondering, how many companies are there that make these machines? And realistically, what's the timeline that states have if they even want to do this by November?
Yeah, I mean, the number of companies, I don't know the full sort of list of companies, but I know that it's a small number. It's you know, in the order of the tens rather than the hundreds of companies that are producing these machines. These machines are expensive. Estimated by one election official, $500,000 to $1 million, and you multiply that across the many different jurisdictions that would need these machines. And so these are the counting machines for ballots, and they're quite expensive. And then you have to train individuals on how to operate the machines. You have to train individuals on how to tabulate the votes. There's a lot of training that needs to go on with respect to the individuals. And I think that that's what makes it sort of extraordinarily challenging. Then you have to educate the public on mail-in voting. And so those are the challenges with kind of implementing a system just on the fly. It's not an on-off switch, which you could switch to mail-in voting just by saying we're going to switch. California was able to do it because we have a no-excuse absentee voting system in which now, in the recent election, 60 to 65% of voters vote by mail. So we have that as a foundation. So the shift to vote by mail is a reasonable – all vote by mail is a reasonable jump. But you have now 24 states, I think, by last count, in which less than 10% of voters voted by mail in the 2016 and 2018 election. something like 3% of voters voted by mail in North Carolina and Virginia, for example, battleground states in 2020, likely to be. 4% voted by mail in the state of Nevada, or 9% in Nevada. So it's a lot of states that are these battleground states that are particularly concerning during the presidential election, in which the vote by mail numbers are extraordinarily low. And to ramp up the systems, to buy the number of machines that could tabulate all these ballots, that's a lot to ask from state and state election registrars.
And it sounds like you're saying they'd have to do it by the middle to late summer.
Yeah. I mean, they would have to start now,
right,
to hope to have it in place by the middle to late summer.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Anthony, let me bring you back in here, because in hearing Professor Ross talk about what it would take to raise levels of vote by mail, I think there's an example of Ohio. Is that illustrative at all in the Ohio primary, which came after
I'm glad
the Wisconsin
you brought,
primary?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you brought Ohio up, because I'd love to hear Professor Ross's response to that. So I'll just lay it out really quickly. So the Ohio primary is an interesting case, because it followed that disastrous April 7th primary in Wisconsin. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine postponed the original primary from March 17th to April 28th. He instituted vote by mail. And what happened? Things went pretty smoothly. None of the drama of Wisconsin. A couple of other things happened. Turnout was very low. That might have been because Joe Biden was already the presumptive nominee, as was President Trump on the Republican side. But the big concern was that even with that very low turnout, election officials had to work really hard to process all those absentee ballots. So the big question is, you know, what will it be like in 2020 when they have to handle a huge load? So that's sort of one of my questions. But Professor Ross, I'm just wondering if Ohio tells us anything about a shift toward vote by mail.
Yeah, it tells us that it's hard to do. So even if you can get voters to shift their voting behavior to vote by mail, you still have the back end challenge of counting these ballots. And right, with Ohio, with the low turnout, it took time to count these ballots. And now you can imagine what will happen during the presidential election in 2020, the general election, in which there's tons of mail-in ballots, and the amount of time it will take to count them. And again, it goes back to the point that I made earlier about election night determinations about who won. That will be virtually impossible with an increased mail-in system.
You know, Professor Ross, it's so interesting, because again and again during this pandemic, we talk about sort of the new normal and what the new normal is. And it seems when it comes to elections, we have to move away from this idea that the polls close at 8 and we're going to know by 9:30 or maybe 11 who the
right,
new president
exactly
is, or whether the president has been reelected. Seems like we really have to get away from that in the new normal here.
We do, absolutely. And we just have to recognize that election officials are working hard. There's nothing nefarious going on with respect to the counting of ballots. It just takes time to count them. It's not a machine that's tabulating your vote instantly. It's one in which they're taking in the mail. They're putting it through a machine. And the fact is, and here's one final point that I'll make about this, some states, many states, allow for ballots to be received so long as they're postmarked on election day, which means that they could come 3, 4, or 5 days after the election and they will be counted. And so we want everyone's vote to count, want everyone's vote to matter, and therefore there are going to be delays.
Well, Professor Ross, we've got 1 minute left here. And the other thing that I'm thinking about, what the new normal might look like, what we don't have is a system outside of the courts to arbitrate election disputes. If we're still going to be relying on candidates conceding and that being the official end of a race, that we don't have anything beyond that.
Yeah, that's what concerns me the most about this 2020 election. If a candidate is not willing to concede, we just don't have. We've relied on norms to decide races. We have laws in place, of course, but mostly we relied on norms. And so it's going to take political leaders and political leadership to ensure a peaceful transition from one term to the next, or a peaceful transition from one president to the next president.
Well, Bertrill Ross is the Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and a member of the Ad Hoc Committee for 2020 Election Fairness and Legitimacy. Professor Ross, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Meghna. Thank you, Anthony. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, Anthony.
Thank you, Professor.
It's so great to have you. Back in the day, Anthony and I used to share a microphone quite a bit, so enjoyed having you alongside me today, Anthony. Anthony is
On Point. It's been great. Thanks, Meghna. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. 2020 correspondent, and he joined us from New Hampshire. Now, folks, just to remind you, tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about quarantine fatigue. Are you starting to bend the rules a little bit? Is your behavior changing? Maybe you're feeling extremely judgy of other folks who aren't wearing their masks properly. We want to know what you're most overwhelmed by and what you yearn to be able to do again. So call us at 617-353-0683, 617-353-0683. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.